This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann, and I am here today. He's back again with Tim Lynch. I had a big introduction for him last time, but he didn't like it. Well, he thought it was too good or something. Here's Tim.
I'm feeling a bit let down by that one, Sam. Maybe you've set the bar too high on this. Maybe from
oh, here's this Tim. He's back. Whatever.
Who's this guy again? He's talking about something. I'm not sure where he's been here.
So, Tim, we've been through anger. We had a series on anger, and we pivoted to hope. We've heard about how the people in Japan, at a place which you can remember the name of,
Minamata.
Thank you. How they pivoted from anger to hope, and we used that as a pivot to hope. So today we have somebody who is quite hopeful.
Yeah, very hopeful. It was interesting. I met... How this came about was on the third day of a music festival in Taranaki. So I wasn't at my most professional, I have to say. So I bumped into somebody and they had a tent up there and they were pushing this wind farm narrative, and I had a bit of a chat to them. I said, oh, really, you want to talk to Giacomi? And I was like, okay, let's do that. And so I didn't. I went back two or three times. I still couldn't manage to find him. So I got his email. I sent him an email and we dragged up the first interview. And unfortunately, that fell through. So we got a second interview set up. And that one fell through because that was when the storms went through in Wellington and he had a tree fall in his backyard and the power got cut off. So we rearranged for another interview, and that was the previous Friday. We finally got to sit down and talk about what he's trying to do. And one of the initiatives that he's in charge of is trying to get offshore wind farms off the coast of Taranaki. And so the conversation was surrounding the benefits, or otherwise, of wind-generated power, and why start in Taranaki in particular.
Yeah, sure. So I am Giacomo Calessi. I'm the director for Copenhagen Offshore Partners in New Zealand. So we are the development arm of Taranaki Offshore Partnership, which is a company that is looking at the feasibility of offshore wind in New Zealand. So it's a new technology for New Zealand, but very, very much well known back in Europe. And we've been exploring for the last 3.5 years what's the possibility of actually building a large-scale offshore wind farm off the coast of South Taranaki.
So why Taranaki? Is there something unique about Taranaki?
Yeah, there is, as a matter of fact. So offshore wind is mostly, the technology has been developed, or is known around the world, using turbines that are fixed to the seabed. In order to do that, we need shallow water depths, say up to a maximum of 60 meters. Now, the coast around New Zealand actually drops quite quickly. The seabed drops quite quickly as we move away from the coast. So there's not that many areas around the coastline of New Zealand that have that shallow water depth that is suitable for offshore wind, fixed bottom offshore wind development. South Taranaki is one of the places that does have that, but there's quite a decent area that has water depths, again, between 20 and 60 meters, and especially the other ingredient, very, very good wind speeds. So those we have pretty much across all the country, but South Taranaki, especially because of the influence of Cook Strait, that provides a bit of a funneling effect, that's where we have the perfect combination of shallow water and high wind speeds. The main technology that is normally used to install the turbines is what we call a monopile. That is a very large steel cylinder. And when I say very large, I mean 10, 11 meters in diameter, and it can be 120 meters long. Really heavy steel hollow cylinder that gets driven into the seabed, and it becomes a bit like, I guess, sticking a nail into the seabed. It's secured to the seabed, and then on top of that, we install the turbine. But you can imagine at that point, it becomes a really, really long, slender structure with a turbine on top, with a very big, heavy mass on top. So there's only so much that we can extend a structure like that. So shallow water allows for a structure that is efficient, economic, let's say, to build, and it's not too flexible because it's not too long.
Well, I mean, the coastal environment, or saltwater in particular, it's incredibly hostile, particularly to, you know, like steel, for instance. Is there particular materials that you have to use that are suitable for
steel? It's just steel, pretty much. Offshore wind has the benefit of the offshore wind industry, which is relatively new, let's say the last 20, 25 years, had the benefit of all the learnings from the oil and gas offshore experience. So, you know, back in Europe and the North Sea, obviously decades of development of offshore oil and gas fields. And the technology there has, thanks, I guess, mostly to the profits that were connected with those developments, there's been really a lot of engineering marvels there. And so all that discovery around how to get structures to survive for 30, 40 years, 50 years even, in that kind of high corrosive environment with enormous waves and currents and winds, all that had already sort of been figured out by the oil and gas people. And so offshore wind started with a bit of a head start there. So yeah, it is a unforgiving environment, but from an engineering perspective, there's nothing mysterious about South Taranaki that we haven't figured out in the North Sea, for example.
It's funny, you don't really think of synergies between sort of wind generation and gas or oil exploration.
Mm. Yeah, as a matter of fact, offshore wind is, we always see it as the merging really of two industries. One is the wind industry, because the let's say the top part of the structure, so the wind turbine, pretty much works the same as for an onshore wind farm, except these turbines are much larger. But the bottom part, how to connect that to the seabed, and again, how to make it survive for 30, 35 years in the water, that has come pretty much wholesale from the oil and gas experience.
And on your website, yeah, you talk about sort of smoothing the transition away from emissions intensive industries such as oil and gas, etc. Could you sort of pull that apart a wee bit for us, like what that transition could look like?
Yeah, sure. So I think that there's widespread acceptance that the future of energy in New Zealand, like in many other OECD countries, is more renewables. I think everybody kind of accepts that there will be some dependence on, for example, gas to, you know, natural gas to provide that sort of firming. But the trajectory is for more renewables to penetrate in the energy market. Now, the low-hanging fruits for New Zealand are the technologies that we already know, like onshore wind and solar farms that are being developed as we speak. But the thing is, we see a future where if we just focus on delivering those, let's call them small projects, because they are relatively small compared to offshore wind, there's just the risk that in 10 years' time, we haven't been able to keep pace with the development that is needed. Offshore wind has the advantage of having large scale and having what we call high capacity factor, i.e. it's a very efficient way of extracting energy from the wind. You get more energy out of an offshore wind farm than you do from an equivalent nearly sited onshore wind farm. And so the role for the energy, for offshore wind really in the energy system, is to provide that, we call it quasi base load. So it runs, it's variable because obviously if there's no wind, there's no generation, but overall offshore we get a better wind resource. And so we generate more energy more of the time. So that's the role that we see offshore wind playing, a bit of a bridge between fully variable generation like onshore wind, and something more that has more of a baseload component like a gas or something that you can just switch on and off, let's say.
I suppose that's one side of the transition, isn't it? I mean, the other side of that sort of economic transition is in the likes of employment. So would you envision that you know, people have been trained or been working in gas or oil industries, would there be a natural way for them to segue into like employment within wind generation?
Yes, yeah, there would be. So that's probably the third ingredient that really works well for Taranaki, and that's why we always thought it was a great opportunity for Taranaki. Taranaki is the energy region of New Zealand. It has been, but in the last, let's say, decade or so, there's been more awareness of the fact that status was connected to the oil and gas industry, and that will not be there forever. And so there's always been an interest in what could a transition look like, and offshore wind has proven itself in the UK, for example, to be a perfect vehicle to move away for workers, to move away from some of those more emission intensive sectors like oil and gas, and keep status of, you know, high paying, well regarded jobs that now operate in a renewable space. A lot of the jobs can transition easily from offshore oil and gas to offshore wind, because a lot of the skills are related more to this, for example, the maintenance of the turbines that requires technicians to be out at sea. And so it's a bit, again, a blending of that wind turbine knowledge with the ability to operate in the marine environment. So, great opportunity there. Again, it's been explored a lot in the UK, and we've seen how some coastal communities have been able to transition away from not just oil and gas, it's been fishing in some cases, and have found the right people in the right place to do these other jobs in the renewable space. So great opportunity there.
So you could see that being as benefit to the wider community and employment. So are there other areas you think there'll be benefit to the community outside of the direct employment?
Direct employment is the first one. One question that I get asked a lot is, if in 10 years' time, which is the sort of time horizon that we're looking at for a full offshore wind farm, if in 10 years' time we have a gigawatt of electricity landing in South Taranaki, I get asked, will that make our bills, electricity bills, cheaper, for example, for people in South Taranaki? I then have to, there's a few answers to that. There's a very complicated answer, which is all electricity generated in New Zealand instantly goes to the entire national grid. And so, you know, you're then effectively buying it from there. So the answer there is it will depend on what the electricity market is doing. More generation like offshore wind is expected to bring down electricity prices. So the answer would be yes, everybody will have cheaper power. But then, you know, there's also a conversation around, we are always trying to work closely with communities to understand what their what the benefits they would like to see from a development like this are. And so if the number one sort of request is to have lower electricity prices, then there's been examples around the world of, you know, rebate schemes that allow a specific community to have lower power prices. So we're still in the very early stages of those conversations. But what's important is that we want to be open in the next few years to understand what do communities actually want out of a project of this scale and significance.
The project wasn't included in the fairly controversial Fast Track bill. But I also saw that the proposed iron sands mining project in the same region has been put on the Fast Track bill. And I was wondering, can you explain in simple terms why you are not part of that Fast Track process?
Yeah, so the main objective of that Fast Track legislation is to allow projects to achieve, environmental consents in a more streamlined way. Other consents as well, but the environmental ones are probably the main ones. We are not, and when I say we, I mean offshore wind developers, are not at that stage yet. We're still in much earlier stages. And admittedly, offshore wind doesn't even have a permitting regime in place yet. That is what we have been working with MBON for the last couple of years. And so setting up effectively the legislation that allows companies like us to for example, acquire some form of rights over the seabed for feasibility studies and so on, the consenting happens at a later stage. So for now, that's not really what we need. Having said that, we are always saying projects like offshore wind are huge, are of national significance. So in a way, they do tick the boxes for fast track inclusion. And so offshore wind will be eligible for fast tracking after the permitting regime is in place. Now, whether we eventually use a fast track or go through other consenting routes, we don't know that yet. I mean, we're certain that we want to do this as in tune with communities as possible. And so, there were obviously one of the controversies of the fast track was it does seem like it strips some powers from communities to, say what they have their say on projects in their area. So that's not what we're doing. Our projects will always be delivered in partnership with communities. But if at the end of the day, it turns out that the fast track is a good sort of harmonized way to put together legislation and to apply for a project, then we might want to consider using it. But at this stage, it's not really where we're at. There's other sort of more pressing issues to be resolved with the permitting regime, I guess.
It's interesting that connection to communities and renewable is a really fraught area.
It is really fraught, but it's interesting because it has to be part of that transition away from large centralized infrastructure, particularly around energy production. And we have had a couple of examples of it. If you think back a few years ago, they actually tried to put a wind farm in Waitati in Blueskin Bay. The Blueskin Energy Project was put forward. And that was really controversial because a lot of the locals simply didn't want these turbines in their neighbourhood. Eventually, it was shut down by the DCC. But even after that, or sort of later, we had Meridian want to put a wind farm on the Lemonmore Range. And that was met with massive controversy. I'm not sure if you saw the Graham Sidney paintings that he defaced himself, one of his famous paintings, The Timeless Land, I think it's called, and he actually graffitied over the top of it in a sort of Banksy style in blood red what these turbines would look like. So the shift from large centralised energy production to community resilience is not a simple one. But it is part of a hopeful change, I hope.
Do you think, we'll come back to the permitting in a second, but do you think there's a risk with the fast track of alienating local community and that buy-in that comes with it?
And that was the main reason for us sort of taking the distances from the fast track when we first heard about it a year and a half ago. It was still very, very unclear what the fast track regime was going to try and achieve, but it did seem like it had a strong component of against sort of going around community interests. We have spent effectively the last 3.5 years trying to have the community doing the journey with us as much as possible. When I say the community, I mean local communities in the South Taranaki, the wider Taranaki community, Iwi, Hapu, everybody. The vision is that a project like this only goes ahead if everyone. It will never be everyone, but let's say 90-95% of people need to have come to the conclusion that this is a good idea, that we do see the benefits, we do see the reason for it being in a specific area, we do understand that the turbines will be visible as small on the horizon, but we accept that is a trade-off versus the against the benefits that it will bring to the region. That's the conversation that we want to have, not trying to sneak something in without people being able to voice their concerns.
Have you been hearing some of the concerns? Obviously, like the potential visual impact. Are there other concerns that community has been raising?
There are valid concerns. This is a big industrial project. So we, for example, from an environmental perspective, we're not claiming that this kind of project has zero environmental impact. So we've always been very forward on the fact that we're talking about 70 large structures deployed at sea with cables running on the seabed, so it's these are the concerns that are absolutely everybody would be right to raise. We've addressed them, we address them regularly in every other market. It's one of the main things that pops up. What we're saying there is, you know, we have the experience from other markets. We know that marine mammals and seabirds tend to be the sort of number one items that everybody wants us to consider, and it makes sense. So that's why a large part of the feasibility studies, and when I say large part, I mean, you know, 2-3 years easily, with tens of millions of dollars spent, is around understanding the baseline environment, understanding what the impact of this kind of structures would be on the marine environment, and effectively understanding whether the trade-off exists, whether whether we can mitigate the environmental impacts as much as possible, and so on. So I think the concerns would be if we or other developers came across as not interested in resolving or mitigating those impacts. So we are being asked, we are basically being asked by the communities in South Taranaki to make sure that, you know, if we do go ahead with this, that we do it in an environmentally conscious way. And that's absolutely part of the mission.
Do you think, because, you know, you would be the first offshore wind farm, do you think that level of transparency is probably more critical?
I think so. And you know, as an experienced, and I'm talking about Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners, we build offshore wind farms all over the world. We have a lot of onshore projects as well. I think CIP by now realize that projects of this scale, even onshore, don't really go anywhere, even from a commercial perspective, unless there is that community buy-in, and especially for new technologies. New technologies, you know, it's stuff that people haven't seen. At the beginning, it's difficult to wrap your head around what does it mean to put 70 turbines in the water. What are the effects? You know, I had all sorts of questions like, well, do the blades actually spin underwater, and will they chop up whales? If you know nothing about that technology, that's a fair question, and I'm there to clarify. No, the blades are well above the water, and to an extent that they're also. Their height is also determined by the height of the seabirds that fly in the area, and you're trying to keep it away from them. So those are all valid questions that need addressing. And I think we have, if we want to be one of the first operators in the region, we accept that there's an extra level of information that we need to put out.
We're going to interrupt the conversation with a song.
Alrighty.
You're not going to sing one?
No. That was to make up for the introduction. No, we're going to go with this guy called Brent Bjork, who I've been listening to. He was from a little band called Caius back in the day. And the interesting thing about Caius is he had one of his bandmates was this guy called Josh Holm, who went on to set up a band called Queens of the Stone Age. After Caius, he went on, he was in another band called Fu Manchu, both of them being quite seminal bands in that sort of desert rock, American blues. Interestingly, he's actually going to be playing in Christchurch in a wee while, which is quite significant. So let's have a listen to Brian Bjork.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. I'm talking with Tim Lynch, who has been talking to Giacomo, who is behind initiatives to put a large-scale wind turbine system off the Taranaki coast. Why is Copenhagen involved?
Well, if you go back a few podcasts, actually, I was in a little place called Bornholm, where I was talking to the sort of initiatives surrounding the same thing and what they're doing. So the Scandinavians are at the forefront of this form of energy creation. They're reimagining what a battery looks like. They're reimagining the role that electricity production plays within society. They're reimagining a whole lot of things. So they're well ahead of the curve on this. So that's very positive. The bit I think where people get maybe a little bit concerned is, in effect, what you're looking here at is a public partnership between New Zealand government and an external for-profit organisation. And that in and of itself is controversial. So the first thing to kind of try and iron out is, well, what does this sort of relationship between Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners, or, you know, CIP, and New Zealand, what does that look like?
So the partnership, Taranaki Offshore Partnership, is a 50-50 joint venture with Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners, which I guess I represent more closely, and the New Zealand Super Fund being the other 50%. So it's the project amongst the ones that are being considered in South Taranaki, the project that has the most New Zealand content because of New Zealand Super's involvement. So that is great. New Zealand Super has a really good sort of handle on what's the value for the country and an interest in maximizing the value for the country. The role of the offshore developer like CIP is really to bring in that expertise on what does it mean to build an offshore wind farm, A, and what does it mean to build an offshore wind farm in a new market, which is a next level of trickiness. Projects like this tap into lots of different spheres. You know, they require an involvement with government that especially New Zealand hasn't necessarily seen in the last 20, 30 years. We call it partnership with government. They require port infrastructure. They require grid infrastructure. They really tap into a lot of spheres. And so you do want a developer who comes in and says, look, we've seen this before. We appreciate that there will be specifics for each country, but overall, we see what the picture is for the next 10 years to actually deliver the first offshore wind farm. So that expertise is not to be discounted, for sure.
No, and I suppose it is the information and knowledge that CIP are bringing to the table on this, would that be speeding up the transition away from oil, gas exploration, things like that?
Yeah, absolutely, because it would enhance the chances of actually delivering the first offshore wind farm. I talk about, you know, the expertise, but really one of the key aspects is also the leverage that a company, that an international company that has already built offshore wind, that the leverage that company will have in the supply chain, for example. You know, if there's a future where in 3 or 4 years' time we're having to pick up the phone and ring one of the very few manufacturers of offshore wind turbines around the world, that's an easier agreement for them to sign with someone who has already ordered many turbines for their projects all over the world. Because it would be a big ask to ask one of those manufacturers to ship only 70 turbines to this side of the world. And that's why we are, for example, doing a lot of work. We have feasibility licenses in Australia as well, and we're planning our projects there, and we're making sure that we tie the development of this New Zealand project with the Australian ones, because then in a few years, picking up the phone becomes to order whatever, 100, 200 turbines rather than just 70. And that just makes, again, the project a lot more commercially deliverable and real, let's say.
Yeah, it's interesting that applying the notion of scalability. And I suppose within that is a sort of shift away from like heavy centralized energy production, such as like hydro dams, et cetera, into something which is more about sort of regional stability.
Yeah. That's interesting. I think it's a bit of a mix of both. There's still an element of central planning, if you want to put it that way, because again, it's a large, the scale that we're talking about would be as large as some of the hydro dams. So it does require a sort of central government's will to have that kind of power being delivered in one spot. At the same time, it has that distributed side of it, because connecting to the North Island, for example, for us has always been, we see it as a big plus of a project like this, you know, in increasing the resilience of the North Island of New Zealand to, for example, a future where maybe the cables in the Cook Strait that connect to the two islands, if there's a fault there, if the cables, for example, when the Alpine fault finally goes, if those cables are, out of service for a number of weeks, then effectively we are looking at two electricity markets, South Island and North Island, separate. And in that scenario, we think that a gigawatt being delivered in the North Island would really help smooth that or allow the North Island to run on its own legs for a little bit longer.
When I was doing having the conversations in Bornholm, one of the things they were talking about a lot with offshore generation for wind was power to X.
Mm-hmm.
And that for them, that was a significant part of where they viewed energy sustainability and energy security lying, as the ability to store energy, change it, and manipulate it. This is a sort of twofold question. The first one is, do you think that notion of power to X has relevance in New Zealand? And the second part of it, you know, in 30 seconds or less for a layman, what is power to X?
Yeah. So maybe I'll start with what is power to X. So there are some, I'll call them chemicals, and I'm not an expert, so if I get it wrong, some chemicals, some molecules that are currently used in a lot of industrial processes, hydrogen being one of them. You can create those molecules by using fossil fuels, which is the standard way of doing it today, or otherwise there's sort of more, let's say, innovative ways of doing it using renewable energy. In many cases, the amount of renewable energy required is very large. So that leads to, there are some great companies in New Zealand that are really at the forefront of thinking around what is the market for these molecules, and can the supply of renewable energy actually match the need for creating the molecules at a cost that we all accept? Heringa is one of the companies based in Taranaki. And so then the question is obvious, would something like offshore wind generate enough renewable electricity with a certain generation profile that enables the production of these molecules like green hydrogen, for example, at a scale that is useful for whatever uses? It could be, heavy. There are some heavy trucks that can run on hydrogen. And so you could see a future where there's trucks running around the country. It's still one of our main ways of getting freight across the country. But they are running on green hydrogen that has been produced by 100% clean energy. So there's some very interesting use cases. Green hydrogen, though, is a bit at the, let's say, at the start of the journey in many ways from a commercialization perspective. And so it's tricky to say whether it will become a full industry of with how much hydrogen will be required. So we're certainly keeping an eye on that, and we would like to be the ones who generate the electricity that goes into something like that. But it's probably not the first use case that we're thinking of. We're focusing on getting electricity in the grid for just decarbonizing the wider grid in New Zealand for now.
Do you think that there's sort of opportunities in New Zealand for innovation, particularly surrounding the notion of decarbonizing the economy and things like that? Do you think this is like a catalyst for innovation, for potentially, reimagining, changing how we operate?
I like to think that it would be an enabler of decarbonizing. I think the two things go together. Certainly bringing something like offshore wind to South Taranaki could, and such a large amount of clean electricity in South Taranaki could inspire some industries to come, for example, to move to the area. And some of those might be the more sort of cutting edge industries that require that access to clean energy. Conversely, I think offshore wind becomes almost, absolutely necessary if in a country that really wants to go for decarbonizing by electrifying. So if there's a future where we really want to get rid of that and process heat and industrial processes that still use a lot of fossil fuel, convert those to electricity, then we're looking at a future where the amount of electricity needed does require large-scale solution like offshore wind, together with all the others like onshore and onshore wind and solar, geothermal. Basically, it will be a all hands on deck at that point.
So, if the plans to, you know, in a perfect world, to put sort of 70 turbines in, how efficient are these turbines? How much electricity are they able to generate? And is it, how can we relate this? What can we relate it to?
Yeah, the sort of turbine size that we are considering for our project is 15 megawatts per turbine. So that is a sort of state-of-the-art turbine nowadays. We think by the time we get to build, there might be even bigger ones, but for now we're sticking with 15. As a comparison, the largest turbines in onshore in New Zealand at the moment, I believe, are between around 6 megawatts. So we're talking about more than double the capacity. And really, in terms of efficiency, because we are putting them out at sea where the winds are more constant and more and stronger, there is higher efficiency, roughly 1.5 times more efficient than the typical onshore or the average onshore wind farm in New Zealand. So that is significant. Again, we're creating a lot of electricity more efficiently. The efficiency is normally achieved by larger turbines. So at sea, we can build much larger structures because they get moved around by enormous vessels, and we don't need to have blades being ferried around the countryside, for example. So that helps.
So it is about the size of the turbines in relationship to the amount of electricity they're able to generate.
Mostly. There's quite a bit that goes into the sort of the smarts of how to operate the actual wind farm. But otherwise, the technology inside the machines, it's not too dissimilar from onshore wind. So it's really a matter of being able to increase the size of the rotor and picking up a lot more power by doing that.
So because it does get pretty windy in Taranaki, and it also stops being windy quite often. How do you mitigate the sort of peaks and troughs of electricity generation that is coming from them?
Yeah, that's absolutely a valid question that we get a lot. So offshore wind, like solar and onshore wind, is a variable renewable energy technology. So we have to accept that there will be periods where we're running at a 100% production and we are actually inputting a gigawatt into the system, and times when there's no wind and we are generating less. The turbines normally have a cut-in speed and a cut-off speed. So a turbine will start generating when wind speeds are around 3 meters per second, which is actually quite slow, as in you would be surprised at when they start generating. So of course, there needs to be regard for it's still a technology that the wider energy system needs to account for the fact that the technology output will fluctuate. But again, the power of offshore wind is in a more consistent output, and also the fact that if we have 1,000 megawatts as our sort of base case of what we're generating, even if we're running at 10% production, that still means 100 megawatts. That's a pretty decent amount of electricity. You know, it's a decent size, the equivalent of a decent size power plant. And so that's where the value comes in having this overall higher capacity factor is what we call it.
And I guess that's possibly one of the advantages of being in partnership with Copenhagen, is that they have experience in how you manage those peaks and troughs. I know salt banks was something of a big conversation in Bornholm.
Yeah. Batteries are an interesting one. I get asked about batteries quite a lot, and often my one of the points I try to make is with projects of this size, we probably need to think of batteries in a different way. The reality is, as we see it, in 10 years' time, again, if we're generating all those gigawatt hours of electricity, each of those gigawatt hours we generate is saving water being used, for example, from the dams in the South Island. And so maybe that becomes a battery, you know, the battery becomes not using that precious water, leaving that in the reservoirs, keeping those hydro dams full and ready to go, while we use more of this variable input from the wind when it's there.
Do you think for, you know, the average New Zealander, that this notion of having inbuilt redundancy in energy generation is something which is seems confusing? I mean, as a country, we're used to having big infrastructure which produces large amounts of electricity and tends not to fail. I'm just thinking of dams and things like here. And the shift away from that large centralized energy production and having multiple forms of smaller energy production, but with inbuilt redundancy within that. Do you think for like New Zealanders, that notion is a stumbling block?
I think a little bit, not just for New Zealanders, I think for many countries, like the idea of there's a future where we move to a fully renewable system where we use only variable renewable technologies. That would require a lot of redundancy, as in we would probably have to build, you know, three times the amount of onshore wind and solar farms that we actually need in order to make sure that even if there's a non-sunny and non-windy day, we're still managing to get enough to run the country. Now, that's not a very efficient way of doing it, obviously, and that's why nobody sort of really suggests going down that route. It's more a matter of making sure that we have enough, that the renewable generation is distributed enough and that we have those sort of storage capabilities built in. At the moment, it's difficult to see how New Zealand would get away without a little bit of gas, natural gas, to firm and to provide that electricity when there's no wind and there's no solar. And that still seems the most efficient way of doing it. My view would be it would be nice to start working towards a future where we don't need that gas as well. But I understand, you know, we understand the implications of a sort of slow transition that make sure that the lights stay on and that we deliver a net zero by 2050 future. So,
if you could, would you be able to paint a picture for us of what, you know, all goes according to plan, and you're able to get these turbines and generators up? What does Taranaki look like in 10 or 20 years?
Yeah, I think Taranaki will look, South Taranaki especially, communities in South Taranaki will at that point be participating in the life of the wind farm in what I think and they think is a very exciting way, for example, working on operations and maintenance. So there will be, if we have the 70 turbines out spinning in South Taranaki, there will be a port town like Pattaya, for example, from where you know, we will have 100 and 150 people employed directly and indirectly with the wind farm, and there will be operators getting on vessels in the morning and technicians sailing out to the wind farm and going out and maintaining the turbines and then coming back, and there will be a control center that looks a bit like a NASA control center to control the wind farm. And all that will be feeding into an energy system that is a lot more resilient and sort of operating at higher margins of clean energy than we are today. So, I mean, I see that as quite an exciting future. There's quite a few people who agree with that. It's not an easy one. It's a long journey. But I think the good thing to remember is we're not talking about a technology that is new or mysterious or unproven, anything like that. We're replicating very successful examples from other countries. There's no reason why we shouldn't be able to achieve the same level of success here.
I mean, obviously, you know, because you're working on this project, something you're personally invested in, is there something about this that makes you excited, that gives you hope for the future?
I always have hope for the future. I'm an optimist by nature. I think the exciting thing will be if we get to actually have an offshore wind farm in South Taranaki, which I think we will do. Certainly we will at some point. It's a matter of whether 2035 is the actual date we think it should be. But I think if we get to that, it will mean that New Zealand and politicians and the energy system, we will have moved towards a strategic approach to developing energy. this project, projects of this scale will not happen with just letting the market do its thing and crossing our fingers. It will have required sort of orchestrated, concerted approach where we will have all figured out together with agencies that there is an optimal mix of technologies for New Zealand in 2035, that offshore wind is part of that, that geothermal is part of that. And so that to me looks like a very, I do believe in the power of sort of agencies and private and investors coming together and planning what a optimal outcome could be and then working towards that. So yeah, I look forward to a future where we've actually gone through that exercise successfully.
Okay, Tim, I've got several questions. One of them is hope techno-solutionist?
Is hope techno-solutionist? I hope is everything. And so, yeah, it has to be techno-solutionist. But there is also this argument that says that we can't buy ourselves out of our obligations, our ecological obligations to the planet. You know, there is an argument that says, you know, if I sell my very large diesel truck and buy an electric car, it is virtue signaling, because in actual fact I should just hold on to my large diesel truck. I can't purchase my way out of this. And so I suppose when, if you look at this idea of hope being techno-solutionist, you could argue that you're framing it in a way that you know, we are able to purchase our way out of these problems. And I don't think you can purchase our way. One of the things about sort of sustainability initiatives and all the people I've spoken to, there's no one singular silver bullet that we're waiting for. It's a series of small incremental change. It's sort of a Kaizen approach to things. It's not the entire population becoming vegan. It's the entire population reducing the amount of meat that they eat on a regular basis.
Giacomo talks about the shift to being more aware of the variability. And maybe we have to find a way of seeing it and hopeful that maybe we can't have the lights on all the time.
Well, it's not that long ago, and this is the reason for the Clyde Dam being built, that was quite common. I mean, if you think about the shift from centralised energy production to having like regional energy production, but within that having like redundancy built into it, that's a deeply terrifying thought, because what we're saying is we're accepting that the wind farm is going to fail. And when the wind farm fails, we're going to kick into the next form of electricity production. And we're accepting that probably will fail as well. So we'll have a third one, which may well be, well, in gas. And Giacomo talks about that, the requirement for gas. We don't like that idea. It's deeply unsettling. We like the idea of having a large entity like the Clyde Dam, which produces a lot of electricity. And when it gets cold, we can always have the ability to turn the heat pump on wherever we want. The idea of inbuilt redundancy is somewhat terrifying. But where it gets hopeful is when you go back to the Copenhagen guys and you go back to the guys in Bornholm, and they're reimagining the role that these turbines play within the community. So they're saying, well, these turbines work really well when they're cool, so we pump water through them, which gets heated up, which we then put through people's houses, so they have warm houses for free. They say, well, what do we do with the surplus energy? Well, we reimagine what a battery looks like, and we use molten salt as a way of storing thermal energy so we can convert it back into electrical energy. And they start saying, well, let's start reimagining what we do with that surplus energy that's been taken from a molten sand pit, and how about we split it and we turn it into hydrogen and then split it again to ammonia, and we start running all of our large offshore boats and rail on that, so we can run it cheaply, efficiently, and with no ecological cost. Which, not getting too political on it, Sam, the ferries that we didn't buy were set up to do.
Giacomo doesn't sound like an angry person.
He does not.
Do you think he had to go through a phase of being angry before he got to hopeful?
He struck me as a pragmatist, very much as a pragmatist. I think at some stage we all have to go through that notion of anger before we can get to hope. Because, you know, anger does play a role in it. It's the motivator. You know, it's the thing that motivates you. It creates action, it creates momentum. It's what allows us to go forward. Hope is the thing that allows us to look to the future for what change can be, But to get to that change, there needs to be a little bit of anger involved in it. So I think there was a little bit of anger in there somewhere. It may have manifested it in a way that it doesn't in New Zealand, perhaps.
From this hopeful reimagining, have you got anything to tell your culinary students yet?
Not just yet. I'm getting there. That's the last part. The last part, that's when I'll have something. Then there will be the big reveal, Sam. I'll give you the big reveal then. But until then, we just have to wait.
In the meantime, let's have a song to go out to then.
All right, so let's go with Trisomy 21. I'm a sucker for a good sounding tremolo effect on a guitar, and for those that aren't guitar nerds like myself, the tremolo effect is the same thing that Johnny Marr from the Smiths use in the song How Soon Is Now. So this is a high energy song called The Camp by Trisomy.
You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. We are broadcast on Otago Access Radio and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. I'm Samuel Mann. This guy that I dragged in, this very fabulous researcher, chef extraordinaire.
I'll get the outro, not the intro.
Is Tim Lynch. That was Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show. Mā te wā.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.